This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print in the May-June issue. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 11th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me today Dorothy Denning. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi.
Dorothy Denning is a professor in the Department of Defense Analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School. In a previous life, she was a distinguished professor at Georgetown and a professor at Purdue, where she got her PhD. Dorothy also did some non-academic work with DEC and SRI. Her book, Information Warfare and Security, is on everybody's bookshelf. And as if that weren't enough, Dorothy is an ACM fellow and was named a Time Magazine Innovator in 2001. So welcome to Silver Bullet.
Thank you.
You've been an academic for much of your career, teaching at Purdue and Georgetown and now NPS. And according to rumor, you even wanted to be a teacher when you found out, before you found out what sixth graders were actually like.
Correct.
So what is the best way, do you think, to teach about computer security?
I don't know what the best way is. I honestly don't. I can only tell you, how I do it, which is to, look at both the attack side and the defense side and try to make some sense out of the field and why we need certain kind of defenses and all that.
Do you think that teaching particular courses on security is the best way to go about it pedagogically, or is it better to maybe try to have a little bit of security in all courses?
No, well, I think you need to have courses that are dedicated to security,
mm-hmm.
particularly topics like cryptography, which would be hard to integrate into some other class.
Absolutely, that makes sense.
But the field is just way, way too big to just squeeze a little bit here and there into other courses. Like, if you've got a course on computer networks, in order to do justice to the security part, really requires another course.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that makes sense to me.
On the other hand, I think you do want to cover some security in courses, particularly courses on software development.
Yeah.
These students have got to understand why it's important to, check your input parameters and do various other things so that the software doesn't end up being shipped with vulnerabilities.
Well, as you can imagine, that's a comment after my own heart. And in some places, I've even seen, people teaching programming 101 in, say, C, and they teach people how to use a dumb function like getS. And then later on, maybe 2 or 3 years later, in an elective, they say, oh, by the way, you should never use a function like this. That seems kind of silly.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think C and C++ are probably the most common introductory languages. I'm not in computer science department anymore, but that was what we taught at Georgetown when I was there.
Yeah, I think that is pretty common still. I'm pleased that some people are moving over to Java and C# and other type-safe languages, which I feel are a lot better.
That's true, although I understand that Java's a lot more complicated maybe for students to learn.
It might be, yeah. Certainly not than C++, which I think is probably the worst language ever foisted on humankind. So
mm-hmm.
hopefully that one will just fall off the face of the earth one day. We can move on. So Greg Hoglund and I cited your book, Information Warfare, which I think is a great book, on page 5 of our book, Exploiting Software. And we did that for a reason, because we wanted people to understand that the kinds of things we were talking about in that book could, in fact, be applied, during wartime. So I wonder, what role does deeply describing and understanding real attacks play in computer security?
Excuse me, I think you need to understand how attacks work, because you need to understand how IP spoofing is working and what's happening during denial of service attacks and how packets are getting past firewalls and all this kind of stuff. If you don't understand that, how can you build a firewall if you don't understand what the threat is against that firewall?
So there's some people who would claim that we should, only allow specialists to have that knowledge because it's too dangerous and it shouldn't be written about or published or talked about. What's your position on that?
Well, I think, you know, again, I don't think you can do good defense without understanding offense.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see how you can teach defense without teaching offense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're talking about, how you want to do authentication, you've got to understand what the threats to password files are and how passwords are cracked and how passwords are sniffed off of networks, and you've got to understand those threats.
Yep, I agree with you with all of those things. I think that sometimes people believe, for whatever reason, that if you just talked about building defect-free software, say, or how cryptography works, security functionality, that you could ignore the attack part because it would become no longer relevant. But I don't think that's really true.
Well, no, because the whole field is evolving constantly. There's constantly new attack methods. And they're outside of the models that we design our security around. So you've got new attack methods coming, and you're constantly having to invent new defenses to go with the new attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And then new software is rolling out continuously, which people find vulnerabilities on. So you get more new attacks, and you need more defenses. So it's the two are coupled. It's like the front and back side of your hand. You can't talk about one really without talking about the other.
Mm-hmm. Possibly one of the deepest controversies you've been involved in professionally was this whole Clipper chip dust-up. And I wondered what it was like being dubbed Clipper Chick or something like that?
Yeah, although actually it was a friend of mine who gave me that name.
No way, really?
Yeah.
That's great. Well, it certainly got picked up and flung around.
Yeah.
I wondered, what was it like kind of being in the middle of that controversy?
It was rough. It was really rough. I felt like it damaged a lot of my relationships with people in the field.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that to some extent some of the arguments were, what would you call it, caricaturing things or making them ridiculously simple in order to make a political point?
Yeah, there was a lot of that going on.
Uh-huh.
But the hardest part for me was the ad hominem attacks.
Right.
And from my perspective, I just, wanted people to have a, rational debate on the topic. But
exactly.
That didn't happen. I was rarely in a setting where it looked like that, and it was such an emotionally charged issue.
Yeah.
And so
I think today, maybe because cryptography has sort of been let out of the box a little bit more, that it might be a lot less controversial, that sort of thing.
Oh, no, I think it would still be emotionally charged if the government was trying to in any way control cryptography.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's what I meant, since the government's not trying to control cryptography.
They gave up.
Right.
They relinquished. And I think that was the right thing to happen.
Uh-huh.
So I think the outcome was okay, but the process was uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's kind of funny when, I guess, people begin to have opinions about you without ever having met you or talked to you.
Yeah.
And I mean any person. That sometimes happens to me, too. It's kind of odd. What do you think was the most valuable lesson that you learned yourself during that time?
I don't know.
Just live through it, huh?
Yeah.
That seems fair enough. Switching gears a little bit, you're widely regarded as the inventor of geoencryption. Do you think that this notion of this sort of spatial concept will escape the defense community and move into things like geographic marketing?
Geoencryption, first of all, it really wasn't my idea. And even location-based security is not my idea.
Mm-hmm.
I originally got involved because Pete McDoran had a company, and he was doing location-based authentication.
Mm-hmm.
And then later I got involved with the folks who were interested in location-based encryption.
Mm-hmm.
And they already had a concept down. And so I tried to provide some greater security and methods for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really deserve credit for the idea.
Fair enough.
And there were other companies.
But you have it out there anyway.
Yeah.
So do you think that's a kind of this sort of geolocation idea is going to be something that catches on in the wider public due to the presence of things like GPS devices in your cell phone and in your car and stuff like that.
Location is certainly taking off now as an important concept in computing and networking.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent, though, that information will be encrypted based on location,
mm-hmm.
or people will be authenticated based on geographic location, I don't know to what extent those might become more prevalent.
Right, right. I guess one of the trade-offs, and there are always trade-offs involved in security, as we all know, is that in order to identify yourself as being in some place, you have to broadcast your location, or at least, you know, skinny cast it. And that could be dangerous, I suppose.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to broadcast your location.
Mm-hmm.
That communication could go encrypted.
And then come to you and only be decrypted if you happen to be at the right place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's right. But I suppose a lot of people are not aware of the fact that many of the gizmos that they carry around have this geolocation capability built into them. Do you think that we should make a point of making people more aware of that, or is it just something that happens and you just sort of live with it?
Oh, it will probably happen at about the rate that's needed in order to understand what's happening with the technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think a lot more people are aware of it. I think many people, know that if they're in an emergency situation or something, that somebody can find out where their cell phone is.
Right, with the 911 stuff.
Yeah.
Especially. Yeah, and in fact, I was talking to some cell phone vendors, because I do a lot of work with them myself, and one of the things they're worried about is they don't want to advertise the fact that you can be geolocated, not because people might be worried about privacy, but because they're worried about liability in case it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, imagine somebody kidnaps your kid and, you know, you're trying to use the cell phone to geolocate them and it doesn't work. Then whose fault is it if it doesn't work, if they've made claims that it does? And so, strangely, that's one of the things that's holding that kind of thing back right now.
Yeah, that could be.
So, you and I have very similar opinions, I think, about cyber criminals. And we both think that cyber criminals are bad and that we shouldn't spend lots of cycles hyping these guys up into rock stars or whatever has happened over the past few years. But your view on that seems to have evolved pretty radically over the years, and I was wondering if you could explain kind of how that happened. What caused you to change your mind, and did it happen all at once, or did it happen gradually?
Well, I don't think my view has evolved all that much.
Okay. So what is your view now?
Oh, there's a lot of bad guys out there. A lot of them are doing it for money.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's just plain old crime.
It's just plain old crime.
And it's always been bad.
Organized crime has discovered that this is a very lucrative way to make money.
Mm-hmm. I guess some people thought that maybe it was because you were just doing computer security much earlier than most people, that talking about hackers was, to some extent, endorsing them, maybe? Or maybe it was a confusion about talking about attacks. What do you think?
Well, back in, I think it was around... if I go way back in history, my early work, honestly didn't pay too much attention to who the bad guys were,
uh-huh.
exactly the methods that they were using. I was looking at security from a totally theoretical perspective.
Gotcha.
So about 80s, around 1990, that was when I did a study where I interviewed some hackers.
I see.
And the hackers I interviewed, which is maybe about a dozen, were all pretty decent folks, I thought.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote an article about them, and, you know, I probably came across as, you know, sounding like these are fairly decent folks.
Oh, maybe that was...
Without trying to necessarily endorse their behavior of breaking into systems.
Yeah, I understand.
I never endorsed.
Yeah.
But then, Don Parker and others got to me and said, you really should go talk to the security administrators and the law enforcement folks,
mm-hmm.
and get their perspective on all that. And I did that, and that process, of course, reminded me that there are a lot of folks out there that have, objectives that are, not benign.
Right.
And so, and I think today, the major threat is coming from people who are interested in making money or causing damage or causing intelligence or all kinds. kinds of things that you really don't want to have happen.
I agree with that. And actually, I think there's some evidence that organized crime is pretty deeply involved, especially Eastern Europe. And, you know, the Eastern European mobs, if you want to call them that, are in cahoots with the Nigerian spammers, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So the Secret Service guys have some very interesting tales to tell about these things.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I do think that it's an important thing to try to understand what the bad guys are doing, and sometimes the best way to do that is to talk to them and to, you know, see it. And just because you're gathering data or trying to understand the enemy, so to speak, doesn't mean that you're endorsing their position. So I can see how those things cohere, really.
Right.
When I visited you at Georgetown before you moved west, we had a lot of fun discovering our joint admiration of Doug Hofstetter. You know, I got my PhD with Doug.
Oh, that's right.
And I wondered, and so Doug was a huge influence on my thinking and still is to this day, but I wondered what influence, if any, have Doug's thoughts about subsymbolic computation and mental fluidity and emergence had on your thinking? Have they influenced the way that you approach the security problem at all?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Just too far afield?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was at a thing at the National Academy of Science recently, and somebody was talking about the way Amazon systems had evolved, and instead of being engineered in a sort of top-down fashion, they just sort of have emerged as this chaotic soup. And they work, clearly, because that's one of the largest retailers. You know, they were one of the first to adopt this new service-oriented architecture idea.
Uh-huh.
And they've really been doing it for several years.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting when you have a system like that that's in some sense an organic thing, defending it can be a lot more difficult than if you are able to engineer a system in a top-down way.
Well, that's what we've got today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole internet and computer networks and everything, it just emerged
mm-hmm.
over time. And so that's part of the reason why it's very hard. And, you know, people have attempted this top-down design of secure operating systems since the very early days, I guess probably the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to do, and, you know, when you finally get your product put together and certified and all that, it's, you know, going to be very expensive, it's going to be obsolete, it's going to be slow.
And people used to sort of the edge of technology will say, my goodness, that seems like an Apple II from 1981.
Yeah, right. I mean, in the meantime, right, the rest of the technology has marched on, and you want it.
Yeah.
Because it's a productivity enhancer. It allows you to do things that you couldn't do before, you can communicate in ways you couldn't before.
Exactly.
So I don't, you know, this top-down approach to building systems and security is great and maybe works well in some small, rather confined kinds of environments.
Mm-hmm.
But for the, for the world at large and the internet and everything, it's never going to work.
So I guess we're sort of doomed, or maybe not doomed, but at least relegated to coevolution in terms of security, where we're caught in this constant arms race, this attack-defense thing, which I suppose is why you, I think, correctly believe that we have to understand attacks as much as we understand defense.
But, you know, it's the same in the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
In the physical world, you know, things evolve. You know, you get new technologies like, you know, automobiles come along and then airplanes, and all this comes along, and it all introduces new security issues, and they don't all get solved.
Mm-hmm.
So the world is a vulnerable place, and we just kind of accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we try to achieve, you know, a reasonable level of security and stability and so on, but
right.
Not perfect.
And we seem to be bumbling along pretty well.
Yeah, but the difference is, you know, with our computer networks is there seems to be this expectation that we could do it right, and that we could do it so that there are no vulnerabilities. And this, to me, is just crazy.
Right.
It's not realistic, and we have to accept that there's always going to be security issues.
Right.
It's not Microsoft's problem. I mean, it's not just Microsoft's problem. It's not their fault.
Oh, they're going to solve it with Vista, haven't you heard?
Well, you know, they're adapting, right?
Uh-huh.
I've been very impressed with what Microsoft has done over the years.
Absolutely. And Mike Howard's work's been good. In fact, I don't know if you know Mike or not, but he was a previous Silver Bullet victim back in episode 3, I think. So we've talked a lot about that over the years. I want to switch gears pretty radically. Your time on the Big Sur Power Walk, which is a 21-mile walk, is trending down over the last 2 years.
And well, it's been about the same.
I wondered whether your 2007 is going to be a breakthrough year. You're going to break your record from 2005.
No, you know, our goal is to enjoy it out there. And, you know, we have 6.5 hours. If it takes 6.5 hours, it's no problem.
It's kind of a nice walk, I guess.
It's a nice walk. It's beautiful. You know, there's no reason to rush it.
I'm jealous of that. Can I come?
Well, it's already sold out. you can run the marathon, though.
I think you're talking to the wrong guy.
Yeah.
And then one last question. What kind of advice would you give to a young scientist who's just starting out in security?
Yeah, I guess both my advice would be something like follow your interests, but follow the law.
Mm-hmm. That seems like good advice.
Yeah, I'm very much against experiments that break the law.
Oh, absolutely. And I think most people agree with that, at least most clever people. Well, great. Thank you very much for your time. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The May-June issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine will feature a print version of this interview. In addition, the issue will be a special issue on managing organizational security and will feature the usual departments, building security in, attack trends on the horizons, and others. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and the IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.